Chapter 2. In this acquaintance the attraction was mutual, and presently it grew to be very mutual indeed, between Shelley and Cornelia Turner, when they got to studying the Italian poets together. Shelley, responding like a tremulous instrument to every breath of passion or of sentiment, had his chance here. It took only 4 days for Cornelia's attractions to begin to dim areas. Shelley arrived on the 27th of July. On the 31st he wrote a sonnet to Harriet in which he detects already a little rift in the lover's lute which had seemed to be healed, or never to have gaped at all, when the later, and happier sonnet to Ianthe, was written in September, we remember. Exhibit deep meaning. To Harriet, thou bright sun, beneath the dark blue line of western distance that sublime descendest, and, gleaming lovelier as thy beams decline, thy million hues to every vapor lendest, and over cobweb, lawn, and grove, and stream sheddest the liquid magic of thy light, till calm earth, with the parting splendor bright, shows like the vision of a bodious dream. What gazer now with astronomic eye could coldly count the spots within thy sphere? Such were thy lover, Harriet, could he fly the thoughts of all that makes his passion dear, and turning senseless from thy warm caress pick flaws in our close-woven happiness. I cannot find the gift, still it may be there. What the poem seems to say is, that a person would be coldly ungrateful who could consent to count and consider little spots and flaws in such a warm, great, satisfying sun as Harriet is. It is a little rift which had seemed to be healed, or never to have gaped at all. That is, one detects a little rift which perhaps had never existed. How does one do that? How does one see the invisible? It is the fabulist's secret. He knows how to detect what does not exist. He knows how to see what is not seeable. It is his gift, and he works it many a time to poor dead Harriet Shelley's deep damage. As yet, however, if there was a speck upon Shelley's happiness, it was no more than a speck, meaning the one which one detects, where he may never have gaped at all or had Harriet cause for discontent. Shelley's Latin instructions to his wife had ceased. From a teacher he had now become a pupil. Mrs. Boinville and her young married daughter Cornelia were teaching him Italian poetry. A fact which warns one to receive with some caution that other statement, that Harriet had no cause for discontent. Shelley had stopped instructing Harriet in Latin, as before mentioned. The biographer thinks that the busy life in London some time back, and the intrusion of the baby, account for this. These were hindrances, but were there no others? He is always overlooking a detail here and there that might be valuable in helping us understand a situation. For instance, when a man has been hard at work at the Italian poets with a pretty woman, hour after hour, and responding like a tremulous instrument to every breath of passion, or of sentiment in the meantime, that man is dog-tired when he gets home, and he can't teach his wife Latin. It would be unreasonable to expect it. Up to this time we have submitted to having Mrs. Boinville pushed upon us as ostensibly concerned in these Italian lessons, but the biographer drops her now, of his own accord. Cornelia Erhup's sole teacher. Hawk says she was a prey to a kind of sweet melancholy, arising from causes purely imaginary. She required consolation, and found it in Petrarch. He also says, Bis entered at once fully into her views, and caught the soft infection, breathing the tenderest and sweetest melancholy, as every true poet ought. Then the author of the book interlards a most stately and fine compliment to Cornelia, furnished by a man of approved judgment who knew her well in later years. It is a very good compliment indeed, and she no doubt deserved it in her 8 years, when as he had 4 generations ceased to be sentimental and lackadaisical, and was no longer engaged in enchanting young husbands and sowing sorrow for young wives. But why is that compliment to that old gentlewoman intruded there? Is it to make the reader believe she was well chosen, and safe society for a young, sentimental husband? The biographer's device was not well planned. That old person was not present, it was her other self that was there, her young, sentimental, melancholy, warm-blooded self. In those early sweet times before antiquity had cooled her off, and mussed her back. In choosing for friends such women as Mrs. Newton, Mrs. Boinville, and Cornelia Turner, Shelley gave good proof of his insight and discrimination. That is the fabulist's opinion, Harriet Shelley's is not reported. Early in August, Shelley was in London trying to raise money. In September he wrote the poem To the Baby, already quoted from. In the first week of October Shelley and family went to Warwick, then to Edinburgh, arriving there about the middle of the month. Harriet was happy. Why? The author furnishes a reason, but hides from us, whether it is history or conjecture. It is because he, babe, had borne the journey well. It has all the aspect of one of his artful devices flung in his favorite casual way the way he has, when he wants to draw one's attention away from an obvious thing, and amuse it with some trifle that is less obvious but more useful in a history like this. The obvious thing is, that Harriet was happy, because there was much territory between her husband and Cornelia Turner now, and because the perilous Italian lessons were taking a rest. And because, if there chanced to be any respondings like a tremulous instrument to every breath of passion, or of sentiment in stock in these days, she might hope to get a share of them herself. And because, with her husband liberated, now, from the fetid fascinations of that sentimental retreat so pitilessly described by Hogg, who also dubbed it Helly's Paradise later, she might hope to persuade him to stay away from it permanently. And because she might also hope that his brain would cool now, and his heart become healthy, and both brain and heart consider the situation and resolve that it would be a right and manly thing to stand by this girl wife and her child, and see that they were honorably dealt with, and cherished and protected and loved by the man that had promised these things, and so be made happy and kept so. And because, also may we conjecture this? We may hope for the privilege of taking up our cozy Latin lessons again, that used to be so pleasant, and brought us so near together, so near, indeed, that often our heads touched, just as heads do over Italian lessons, and our hands met in casual and unintentional, but still most delicious and thrilling little contacts and momentary clasps, just as they inevitably do over Italian lessons. Suppose one should say to any young wife, I find that your husband is poring over the Italian poets, and being instructed in the beautiful Italian language by the lovely Cornelia Robinson, would that cozy picture fail to rise before her mind? Would its possibilities fail to suggest themselves to her? Would there be a pang in her heart, and a blush on her face? Or, on the contrary, would the remark give her pleasure, make her joyous and gay? Why, one needs only to make the experiment, the result will not be uncertain. However, we learn by authority of deeply reasoned and searching conjecture that the baby bore the journey well, and that that was why the young wife was happy. That accounts for 2% of the happiness, but it was not right to imply that it accounted for the other 98 also. Peacock, a scholar, poet, and friend of the Shelleys, was of their party when they went away. He used to laugh at the Boinville menagerie, and was not a favorite. One of the Boinville group, writing to Hogg, said, "The Shelleys have made an addition to their party in the person of a cold scholar, who, I think, has neither taste nor feeling. This, Shelley will perceive sooner or later, for his warm nature craves sympathy." True, and Shelley will fight his way back there to get it. There will be no way to head him off. Towards the end of November it was necessary for Shelley to pay a business visit to London, and he conceived the project of leaving Harriet and the baby in Edinburgh with Harriet's sister, Eliza Westbrook, a sensible, practical maiden lady about 30 years old, who had spent a great part of her time with the family since the marriage. She was an estimable woman, and Shelley had had reason to like her, and did like her, but along about this time his feeling towards her changed. Part of Shelley's plan, as he wrote Hogg, was to spend his London evenings with the Newtons, members of the Boinville Hysterical Society. But, alas, when he arrived early in December, that pleasant game was partially blocked for Liza, and the family arrived with him. We are left destitute of conjectures at this point by the biographer, and it is my duty to supply one. I chance the conjecture that it was Liza who interfered with that game. I think she tried to do what she could towards modifying the Boinville connection, in the interest of her young sister's peace and honor. If it was she who blocked that game, she was not strong enough to block the next one. Before the month and year were out, no date given, let us call it Christmas, Shelley and family were nested in a furnished house in Windsor, at no great distance from the Boinvilles, these decoys still residing at Bracknell. What we need, now, is a misleading conjecture. We get it with characteristic promptness and depravity. But Prince Athanas found not the aged Zenoras, the friend of his boyhood, in any wanderings to Windsor. Dr. Lind had died a year since, and with his death Windsor must have lost, for Shelley, its chief attraction. Still, not to mention Shelley's wife, there was Bracknell, at any rate. While Bracknell remains, all solace is not lost. Shelley is represented by this biographer as doing a great many careless things, but to my mind this hiring a furnished house for 3 months in order to be with a man who has been dead a year, is the carelessest of them all. One feels for him that is but natural, and does us honor besides, yet one is vexed, for all that. He could have written and asked about the aged Zenoras, before taking the house. He may not have had the address, but that is nothing. Any postman would know the aged Zenoras. A dead postman would remember a name like that. And yet, why throw a rag like this to us ravening wolves? Is it seriously supposable that we will stop to chew it and let our prey escape? No, we are getting to expect this kind of device, and to give it merely a sniff for certainty's sake, and then walk around it and leave it lying. Shelley was not after the aged Zenoras. He was pointed for Cornelia and the Italian lessons, for his warm nature was craving sympathy. 2. The year 1813 is just ended now, and we step into 1814. To recapitulate, how much of Cornelia's society has Shelley had, thus far? Portions of August and September, and 4 days of July. That is to say, he has had opportunity to enjoy it, more or less, during that brief period. Did he want some more of it? We must fall back upon history, and then go to conjecturing. In the early part of the year 1814, Shelley was a frequent visitor at Bracknell. Frequent is a cautious word, in this author's mouth. The very cautiousness of it, the vagueness of it, provokes suspicion. It makes one suspect that this frequency was more frequent than the mere common everyday kinds of frequency which one is in the habit of averaging up with the unassuming term frequent. I think so, because they fixed up a bedroom for him in the Boinville house. One doesn't need a bedroom if one is only going to run over now and then in a disconnected way, to respond like a tremulous instrument to every breath of passion or of sentiment and rub up one's Italian poetry a little. The young wife was not invited, perhaps. If she was, she most certainly did not come, or she would have straightened the room up. The most ignorant of us knows that a wife would not endure a room in the condition in which Hogg found this one when he occupied it one night. Shelley was away, why, nobody can divine. Clothes were scattered about, there were books on every side, colon wherever a book could be laid was an open book turned down on its face to keep its place. It seems plain that the wife was not invited. No, not that. I think she was invited, but said to herself that she could not bear to go there and see another young woman touching heads with her husband over an Italian book and making thrilling hand contacts with him accidentally. As remarked, he was a frequent visitor there, where he found an easeful resting place in the house of Mrs. Boinville, the white-haired Mimuna, and of her daughter, Mrs. Turner. The aged Zenoras was deceased, but the white-haired Mimuna was still on deck, as we see. Three charming ladies entertained the mocker Og with cups of tea, late hours, while Aunt Zagathan, sighs and smiles, and the celestial manna of refined sentiment. Such, says Og, were the delights of Shelley's paradise in Bracknell. The white-haired Mamuna presently writes to Og. Will not have you despise homespun pleasures. Shelley is making a trial of them with us, a trial of them. It may be called that. It was March 11, and he had been in the house a month. She continues. Shelley likes then so well, that he is resolved to leave off rambling, but he has already left it off. He has been there a month. And he begin a course of them himself. But he has already begun it. He has been at it a month. He likes it so well, that he has forgotten all about his wife, as a letter of his reveals. Curiously, I think his mind and body want rest. Yet he has been resting both for a month, with Italian, and tea, and manna of sentiment, and late hours, and every restful thing a young husband could need for the refreshment of weary limbs and a sore conscience, and a nagging sense of shabbiness and treachery. His journeys after what he has never found have racked his purse and his tranquility. He is resolved to take a little care of the former, in pity to the latter, which I applaud, and shall second with all my might. But she does not say whether the young wife, a stranger and lonely yonder, wants another woman and her daughter Cornelia to be lavishing so much inflamed interest on her husband or not. That young wife is always silent, we are never allowed to hear from her. She must have opinions about such things, she cannot be indifferent, she must be approving or disapproving, surely she would speak, if she were allowed even today, and from her grave she would, if she could, I think, but we get only the other side, they keep her silent always. He has deeply interested us. In the course of your intimacy he must have made you feel, what we now feel for him. He is seeking a house close to us, ah, he is not close enough yet, it seems, and he, if he succeeds we shall have an additional motive, to induce you to come among us in the summer. The reader would puzzle a long time, and not guess the biographer's comment upon the above letter. It is this. He sound like words of S. considerate and judicious friend. That is what he thinks. That is, it is what he thinks he thinks. No, that is not quite it. It is what he thinks he can stupefy a particularly and unspeakably dull reader into thinking it is what he thinks. He makes that comment with the knowledge that Shelley is in love with this woman's Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.